Thank you. You may be seated. One of these days, I want to have an opportunity just to come and to share with you in a little more detail about my journey into the CEC. But for today, just let me say that in late 1995, I had determined that I was not going to come into the Charismatic Episcopal Church. And then New Year's Eve, December 31st, 1995, and on Sunday, January the 1st, 1996, I visited Church of the Messiah. And everything about my life changed. Everything about my ministry. I'd been in ministry almost 25 years by that time. And just the short version of the long story is that had it not been for my experience at Church of the Messiah, I would have probably stayed where I was. I would not be a priest and, in the extreme wry humor of God, a bishop in the CEC. The deacons and priests who are part of my church in Georgia would not be where they are. There would not be a Christ the King church in the Mid-South Diocese. And so when I come home, whether it was at the other location or here, or whether I come to your new place that's going to be built before too long, I feel like I'm coming home. And one of these days I'll tell you that long story, but I understand that Father David has already caused you to have a couple of long services in a row. And so I'm going to try not to do that. I can't promise, you know, because it is the tradition of bishops that they don't know when to be quiet. Although, as I shared with the men this weekend, my wife reminded me as I came, just remember, honey, it doesn't have to be eternal to be divine. So, but as Father David took me by the land this morning with a couple of the men of the church, and we were able to see that, and I was thrilled when I saw the dedication service on the website, and I know that things are moving forward. And it was just before the service started that I went to Father Paysinger, and I said, I really think that I've got a couple of ways I can go. I was going to go a certain way in this message, but after I was on the land, it was like, well, now there's this other way to go now. And so I sort of sought some counsel from him on what he thought to help me out on what the Holy Spirit might be saying to you. And so this was not what I was intending to share with you this morning until I went to the land. So I just trust that the Lord wants to speak what I'm about to speak to you, and I just pray that his words would come through and his intentions would come through, and that the messenger would try not to mess it up too much. I want you to imagine the foolishness of someone who decides to go fishing. And that's not foolishness, of course, but he tells you that he's going to go fishing. He gets his fishing gear on, and he gets his equipment together, his tackle box, his rod and reel, and he gets his bait. And he goes to his office and sits behind his desk and begins to cast into his office. And if you walk in and you say to him, what in the world are you doing? And he says, well, I'm fishing. Now, you don't know whether he's just crazy or whether he's just crazy. Because it's obvious to everybody that who sees him fishing that it's impossible to fish where there are no fish. I mean, I suppose you can cast your line. I suppose you can do all sorts of things. But it is folly to fish in the office, is it not? When Jesus called several of the disciples to follow him, he said, follow me and I will make you fishers of men. And if we as believers or if we as members of churches expect fish to come to where we are, we're just as mad as the man in his office casting his line into his trash can. Amen. It's madness to think that's the way it works. I've met people in my time in the ministry, almost now 40 years of ministry, who honestly believe that if they just gathered a small crowd and put a sign out front, then the people would flock in. And people who think that are bound to be disappointed unless there's a God move, which sometimes happens, but that's not the normal way God moves. And if they really wonder why the fish haven't come to them, then seriously, they need some type of therapy. You must go after the fish. if you're going to be a fisherman, how many are fishermen here? You know this is to be the truth, correct? And you must go where the fish are. You must go and find them. There is an interesting way to fish that you may or may not be familiar with, and it's called noodling. Does anybody know what noodling is? It's also called hillbilly hand fishing. For those of you who don't know what noodling is, and they actually have national noodling tournaments, it's when people go to a river or a lake and they wade into the water. Usually the water is dirty and muddy. They have no lines, they have no rods, they have no reels, they have no bait. They're looking for places where catfish hide. And they find these, and they stick their hand into these places that they feel around they cannot see, and their goal is to reach in into the mouth of a catfish. And when the catfish closes its mouth around their hand, they hold on to it and pull it out. This is now a sport in the United States. It now has national tournaments. I mean, I am from Northeast Tennessee in the mountains, and I'd never heard of such a thing. But the national tournament was held in Oklahoma, which explains a lot. But there are reality shows about noodling, and it's really quite fascinating. In fact, there's a whole business now that if you decide you want to learn how to noodle, or to hillbilly handfish, if you like that better, then you can actually take a course, and they'll take you, men or women, they'll take you out and teach you how to noodle, how to stick your hand in a place you would never normally stick your hand because you don't know what's in there, and you hope something's going to bite you. As I was watching this series of shows, and I didn't watch them all, the fact that I watched one of them all the way to the end says something about me. But it was fascinating to me. But one of the secrets that these people have who are in this tournament, it's not really a secret. One of the understandings, I guess that would be, that these men in this tournament have is they understand that you have to go find where the fish are hiding. And so they go to places that no sane person would go into the muddy water. I mean, you know, there are snakes in the water, too. I keep thinking, well, if I stuck my hand in a hole, surely I'd find a snapping turtle. I mean, that'd be what I would find. Or I stick my hand in some hole and some water moccasin would bite down on me. But they seem to have no such problem. In fact, they bear some scars on their hands. Yeah, that's where that big 60-pound catfish bit me right there. And I saw one guy pull out a 60-pound catfish out of a lake. And it's quite interesting. And they'll bring their fish back at the end of the... It's like the tournament runs on Friday and Saturday on consecutive weekends for 8 weeks, and then the total poundage of the fish caught at the end determines the winning team. I like fish. I like to eat fish. I like to eat catfish. I've never in my life seen a 60-pound catfish, but it wasn't unusual to see these guys catch them. But in order to catch these prize-winning catfish, they had to go where the fish were, and they had to do whatever it took, okay, to reach their hands in there, to take a risk, and catch these fish. It was fascinating. It really was fascinating. There are at least two reasons why we are to go, why you and I are to go fishing for men, and to go where they are. One reason is found in the book of 2 Kings, chapter 7. Now, a little background on this passage is that there was a war that was going on, and a city was surrounded and under siege. Now, the problem that people in the city have that's under... Now, one way of making war is to put a city under siege. That means that basically you surround the city, you cut off anyone coming out of the city, you cut off any supplies going into the city. If you're able to maintain the siege long enough, what will happen is that the city will starve to death. Or if it doesn't starve to death, they will surrender because they're about to starve to death. Or, in their weakened state, they'll decide they have to launch a fierce attack And in their weakened state, they'll attack those who are at siege against them, and they would be supposedly easy pickings. So the city is under siege in 2 Kings chapter 7. And we come to this place where there are, where really the siege has been going on for quite some time. The circumstances in the city of Samaria are desperate. You can't find anything to eat. There's probably not a rat left in the city. Probably not a dog. Probably very few animals that are left in the city. There's simply no food. And there were four leprous men at the gate of the entrance to the city. Now, these four leprous men are at the gate of the city because they're unclean. They have leprosy. They're not allowed to associate with common, ordinary people because of their disease. But they, too, are under siege, and they, too, are starving. For the most part, leprous people were able to survive only because they were able to beg and count on the generosity of people who had bread or food or money. And there's no bread, there's no food, there's no money. And so they are starving right along with the rest of the city. And so they said to one another, "Why do we sit here until we die? If we say we will enter the city, the famine is in the city, and we shall die there. If we sit here, we die also. If we therefore come and go to the camp of the Arameans, if they spare us, we will live. And if they kill us, we shall but die." These are desperate men. They figure that if they go to visit the Arameans, at least it'll be a swift death. The worst that can happen is they'll have a swift death instead of a lingering death in the city or at the gates. And they rose at twilight to go to the camp of the Arameans. And when they came to the outskirt of the camp of the Arameans, behold, there was no one there. For the Lord had caused the army of the Arameans to hear a sound of chariots and a sound of horses, even the sound of a great army, so that they said to one another, "Behold, the king of Israel has hired against us the kings of the Hittites and the kings of the Egyptians to come upon us." Therefore they arose and fled in the twilight and left their tents and their horses and their donkeys, even the camp just as it was, and fled for their life. Of course, the campfires were still burning. They had all the appearance of being occupied, but there was no one there. And when the lepers came into the outskirts of the camp, they entered one tent, and what they found there was all the food that had been left behind too, and all the drink that had been left behind. So they ate and they drank as much as they could possibly hold, and they carried from there silver and gold and clothes, and they went and hid them. And they entered another tent and carried from there also and went and hid them. And then, I don't know how much time had passed, but they looked at each other and they said to one another, "We are not doing right. This is a day of good news. But if we keep silent, if we wait till morning light, punishment will overtake us. Now therefore come, let us go and tell the king's household." So they came and called to the gatekeepers of the city, and they told them, saying, "We came from the camp of the Arameans, and behold, there was no one there, nor the voice of man, only the horses tied and the donkeys tied and the tents just as they were." Of course, the gatekeepers called and told it to the king's household, and he arose in the night, and he thinks it's a ploy, that it's a trap. But the bottom line is that in their desperation, they send out scouts to go and see if this report is true, and it is, and the doors are open, and the people from the city, the starving people from the city, flood out to the camp of the Arameans, and the city and the people are saved. They discovered that God had done the work. He had done all that needed to be done. All the people in the city of Samaria needed was someone to come and to tell the good news. If the lepers had waited at the camp of the Arameans for the people to come to where they are, every man, woman, and child, the king, and every pauper would have perished from starvation. They had to go, and they had to tell. One reason that we are to go is because of the desperate need. We also have a second reason to go where the people are, and that is because we have a divine commandment to go. In Matthew chapter 28, beginning with verse 19, Well, beginning with verse 18, Jesus came and spoke to them saying, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. And lo, I am with you always, even unto the ends of the earth." Now, I'm here to tell you that there are those who are going. There are people who are going to where the fish are. There are those who are wading in the deep waters, in the muddy waters of society, to try to find those fish that are hard to locate. The Mormons are going. They are going regularly every day to where people are. The Jehovah's Witnesses are going. They are going every day to where they believe people may be found. Did you know that since September 11th, 2001, that since 9/11, in the United States of America, there has been a 74% increase in mosques in America? 74% increase of Muslim mosques in America since 9/11. The Muslims are going. Someone's word is getting out. There are people out there who are fishing with intensity. Now, here's a number that you need to know. And it's the number 84. You're about to look at plans and consider plans for relocation. In the near future, following the dedication, there's going to be some activity out there, and at some point in the near future, whatever plans that will eventually get approved will result in a building, and Church of the Messiah will move to where there's a four-lane road, a busy thoroughfare, and then what? You need to know the number 84. 84. Write that down somewhere, 84. Well, what is this number? This number is the most important number in growing your church. And here's what it is. 84 across the nation, regardless of denomination, 84% of the people who visit a church for the first time, 84% of people who visit a church for the first time do so because they were invited personally by a coworker, a neighbor, a friend, or a relative who already attended that congregation, who was already present in the pews, 84%. Churches and denominations spend millions and tens of millions of dollars in other methods. Newspaper ads, television ads, direct mail ads, all sorts of things, all sorts of different activities designed to bring people into the church. But the most they will ever reach of the potential people who can come to that church is 16%. An enormous amount of money is spent targeting the 16%, while the 84%, those are in your hands. They're in my hands. That's how they will be reached. Yet, even though 84% of people who will come to my church in Georgia or come to your church here in Jacksonville, 84% will come because you or someone in this congregation invited them to come. And yet most churches totally ignore this fact. Not speculation, this fact. When I was 15 years old, I just left the ninth grade. I believe it was June. And my first girlfriend, with whom I fell madly in love, had dumped me for a guy with a car. I thought I was going to spend all summer at her house, you know, and falling even more madly in love than I had at 14. And but when summer came, I know it was before August, because August football practice started in August, and so I had some leisure time, and and didn't know what to do. I was sitting on the front porch of my house in a blue-collar neighborhood in Kingsport, Tennessee, one Sunday afternoon, about 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock perhaps. I was in a little garage band. I mean, this was the mid-60s. Everybody was in a band or wanted to be. And you either wanted to be a singer or you wanted to be a musician or you wanted to be a drummer. I'm just kidding, drummer. My grandson is a drummer at our church, and I tease him. I said, I'd like to have a meeting of the musicians, and you too, drummer, you can come with me. So I only do that because he's my grandson. And if the truth be told, on my bucket list is to learn to play the drums. But I was playing my Fender Music Master guitar, you know, and just trying to learn some songs. And a car drove past my house and stopped. Sat there for a moment. And my house was not on anybody's way to anywhere. So you were either lost or you lived in the neighborhood or you were deliberately going to a house. That's the only way you went past my house. And it turns out they were lost. And so the car backed up and stopped in front of my house, and out stepped a man who was driving the car who looked to be an old guy, about 30, 33 years old, something like that. And two girls who were slightly older than me and stunningly beautiful. In fact, Andrea Carter, who was the sort of the spokesman for this group, looked an awful lot like Linda Carter of Wonder Woman fame. My attention was secured as I watched them walk and then with great surprise walk into our yard and come up on the front porch and sit down and introduce themselves. It seems that the pastor, whose name was Fred Austin, the man, was the new pastor at the Methodist Church, not far from my house, a couple of miles from my house. The church had been there 100 years, was a little white church, and he was the new pastor. Had been trained as an engineer and had gone to Asbury Theological Seminary, and I don't know if he was in his first church or not, but he was a new guy. And there were these two girls there. I didn't care about him. And so the girls invited me, wanted to know if I wanted to go to this youth group. And they told me what all they were going to be doing during the summer. And most of it was social activities and all this kind of stuff. And so when I asked them what a youth group was, they told me. And so my dad was gone somewhere, so I asked my mother. I said, Mom, be okay if I go with these folks to this youth group a couple of miles away? She said, sure. And so I was pretty excited, and I got in the car, and Andy was in the back seat. I slid into the back seat next to Wonder Woman. And I said, well, how many kids are in this youth group? She looked at me and smiled the most beautiful smile I'd ever seen up to that time and sweetly said, well, now there are three.